So, Jay, if Magneto wins the Magneto War...
When Magneto wins the Magneto War?
Spoilers!
Dude, Miles, it's a 30-year-old story. Magneto wins.
So he gets his own country?
He does indeed.
What does he do with it?
Okay, so you remember Fabian Cortez?
The creepy upstart who formed the Acolytes just so that he could try to kill Magneto, then kidnaps Magneto's granddaughter to start a civil war on Genosha?
That's the one. Magneto makes him...
suffer for his crimes.
His right-hand man.
What?!
I'm Jay Edidin.
And I'm Miles Stokes.
And we are here to explain the X-Men.
Because it's about time someone did.
Welcome to episode 445 of Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men, where we walk you through the ins, the outs, and the retcons of comics' greatest superhero soap opera.
And welcome to a brand new era. Sort of.
That's right, because this is the story where everything changes. Again, kind of, but not really. But first, a quick reminder. This weekend, this Saturday, April 13th, will be our 10th birthday party and live show, respectively, at Books with Pictures in the Clinton Street Theater. You can find information for both at explainthexmen.com. We'll stick a link in the visual companion. Hopefully, we'll see you there.
Yes, indeed. I can't believe how soon that's coming up. I mean, less soon as we record this, because we're recording it ahead of time. But listeners, we assure you, we are thinking about that a great deal. There are a lot of logistics, it turns out.
So many pies to get.
So many pies. Which is to say, logistics.
The pies are a metaphor that are also actual pies.
Exactly. But outside of the immediate real world of a gathering, we also want to tell you about some X-Men. We do that a lot around here.
I guess.
So the careful listener who listened to our previous episode, say, may recall that we just finished the Steve Siegel and Joe Kelly runs of Uncanny X-Men and X-Men, respectively.
And now we have another event. That's right. Everything will change, except not really.
Yeah, this is an era where there are kind of quite a few events, and not gigantic Age of Apocalypse Onslaught-style events, but more like stories, which will last for, say, half a dozen issues or something like that, that have an impact on the ongoing plot, and then just sort of lead into the next story like that.
And have their own little one-shot tie-in issues.
Sometimes, one of which we'll be covering this episode. We are also at the beginning of a surprisingly long run where Alan Davis is plotting not one, but both core X-books.
Now, you would think if you read and enjoyed or heard us read and enjoy Davis's run on Excalibur that this would be cause for intensive celebration. And it's cause for mild, moderate celebration, but unfortunately here, instead of having the kind of free reign he did on Excalibur, Davis is basically taking a list of editorial directives and getting a bunch of characters and plot setups from point A to point B, so you don't hear nearly as much of his voice coming through.
So when Siegel and Kelly quit, from what we understand, fed up with interference from maybe editorial, maybe marketing, maybe the toy line, unclear, business stuff anyway, the books needed, you know, a new writer. And so Marvel asked Chris Claremont, who was on other books at the time, who he'd recommend. He suggested his buddy Alan Davis, with whom he'd worked on Excalibur back in the day. And so Davis said, all right, I'll plot some books, no prob. But the job sort of grew and grew. He was just going to do it for a short amount of time, do some of the art as well. And then he did it for a longer time and a longer time and a longer time.
Yeah, I think what was supposed to be a 6-month gig turned into about 2 years.
Yeah, or like a year and a half or something, much longer than it was planned to be. There's an Alan Davis quote here as well, as he describes this sort of workmanlike quality he'd been forced into.
I was problem-solving rather than coming up with ideas that I would have chosen.
And indeed, we don't get that sort of wacky, delightfully convoluted Davis that we got in his run writing Excalibur. We get some stories that are totally readable. They're not bad, but they're not that level of special.
Part of that, too, is that Davis is only plotting here. He's not doing dialogue.
That's right. The dialogue, at least for the issues we'll be covering for the next little bit, is by Fabian Nicieza. Hey, Fabian's back.
Yay!
So Fabian Nicieza's dialogue is also great, but again, we get the impression this is just a gig. You know, there's a bit of clock punching to this whole thing. And I don't want to say this isn't fun to read. It is. I think part of it is just that we had that phenomenal Siegel-Kelly run that ended with a similar vibe to the vibe that we're starting with here.
Part of it, too, is that Davis and Nicieza are kind of filling in space that already exists. So they're writing to a pre-required length, and that is way, way longer than the story actually requires.
Indeed. We just finished The Hunt for Xavier not too long ago, and we are diving right into the Magneto War.
Yay.
Yay. And now I shall say a phrase that we're hearing a lot more on screen these days. The new cartoon is so good. Previously on X-Men.
Lately, the X-Men have been shifting back to a familiar status quo. Professor X is back at the mansion, some Bronze Age members of the team have rejoined after years on Excalibur, and most of the recently introduced characters, except for Marrow, have been written out.
So what's that status quo missing? Why, Magneto, of course.
But Magneto's return is gonna have to be more complicated than you might expect if you were coming in from the Bronze Age, for instance. Because the last time the X-Men saw Magneto was when Professor X shut down Magneto's mind after Magneto ripped the metal out of Wolverine's skeleton back in the 1993 crossover Fatal Attractions, six publication years ago.
After that, Magneto was watched over by his cult-like acolytes while he was in a vegetative state until he disappeared after their space base, Avalon, crashed to Earth.
Further complicating the situation, a much younger version of Magneto has appeared, calling himself Joseph, and devoid of any memories of his presumed former life as Magneto. He's also got beautiful long white hair, very resplendent.
Joseph joined the X-Men for a time, meeting the team's membership requirements by helping them fight villains and stirring up interpersonal drama, the latter of which was kind of about unresolved romantic interest in Rogue. The careful listener may also recall that Magneto and Rogue had a thing in the Savage Land for a while.
Joseph also had a brief stint with the Acolytes, who worshipped him the way they'd worship the older Magneto, which creeped him way, way, way out. He ended up going back to the X-Men, at least until he found out that he actually might not really be a de-aged Magneto, and ghosted the team to wander off with Israeli mutant Sabra to figure out his true identity.
So if Joseph isn't Magneto, where's the actual Magneto?
Well, remember Eric the Red?
How could I ever forget our favorite space bondage Viking?
Our favorite space bondage Viking and communal disguise. Because Eric the Red turned up to judge a sham trial for Gambit in Antarctica and revealed himself, ultimately, to be Magneto. The real one.
Well, revealed himself to us, not to the X-Men. They still don't know. And more recently, Magneto threatened a nice construction foreman named Bill Jones until Bill freaked out enough to say anti-mutant things, and that helps Magneto decide that he did indeed want to declare war on humanity.
Hey, Bill did not say general anti-mutant things. Bill said explicitly anti-Magneto things, which were entirely fair under the circumstances.
I don't think Magneto is paying attention to the details, unfortunately.
Magneto is a dick.
And that dick is now declaring war. A war one could almost call...
Dick War!
Well, I was thinking, the Magneto War!
Mine's better.
Yeah, probably. But that does bring us to X-Men The Magneto War, number 1 of 1, Savior Complex. This double-sized one-shot has a story by Alan Davis, a script by Fabian Nicieza, pencils by Lee Weeks, inks by Dan Green, colors by Marie Javins and Monica Kubina, and letters by Richard Starkings and Comicraft.
The one never far behind the other.
Richard Starkings and Comicraft, like Wayne and Garth. I don't know which is which.
Or like Wayne and the World.
Huh. This is just getting way too metaphysical for Wayne's World, or maybe X-Men for that matter.
So, I want to start with this cover because I hate it.
Oh, I kind of love it.
Do you?
Well, okay, it's not a great cover. I agree. It's like this super airbrushed, posed cover.
It looks like the cover of a bad tie-in novel.
And that's why it's fun, because it reminds me of like some of the X-Men novels we've read, like that one Star Trek one. They all had these weird airbrushed, posed covers. This one has Joseph Storm and Wolverine. It is odd.
They're not doing anything. They're just there.
Posing, you know, for a cover. This issue opens with a quote from Longfellow's book, Kavanagh.
We judge ourselves by what we feel ourselves capable of doing, while others judge us by what we have already done.
Which is definitely relevant to both Professor X and to Magneto, and brings us back to my favorite cognitive fallacy, the fundamental attribution error. See last episode for more information on that.
But don't judge us for it.
They probably will. So Professor X sleeps, as the narration tells us of his journey through the plot of X-Men over the years. Relevant is this part right here.
Over time, that fight became a war, and the students became soldiers. Eventually, the teacher woke up to see a general in his reflection, so he smashed the mirror to bits. And the X-Men have been picking up the pieces ever since.
So, I don't know, what do we think about this statement? Does this apply? Is this accurate for this point in X-Men history?
I think the phrasing is brilliant. Specifically, that instead of changing himself, he smashed the mirror.
So he couldn't see it anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing. He's back with the X-Men, and while he's not giving people demerits the way he was that one time the X-Men came back from their world tour back in the 70s.
I like to think he's always giving people demerits in his mind. He's just learned not to verbalize it.
He has like a little tally on the astral plane. He's just, you know, carving it into the wall with his Centurion sword in his astral armor.
Yeah.
But yeah, we do have our old status quo back, and Professor X is pondering more. He still certainly feels very uncertain after becoming Onslaught and then coming back to the team, but the structure is similar. What's different now is that he's really questioning his dream. We saw some of that in the lead-in issue to the Magneto War, the one with poor Bill Jones. What Professor X is doing right now, though, is dreaming of this beautifully drawn, futuristic version of New York City, with humans and mutants hanging out together in parks and flying through the sky and having picnics and playing with their kids. And Xavier himself is going through this idyllic scene with Scott Summers and Jean Grey by his side, as one would expect. Everything is perfect.
At least until a bunch of anti-mutant protesters march forward, throw him to the ground, and, you know, burn everything.
It's got that sort of dreamlike, sudden, and accelerated timeline where, like, you're dreaming and all of a sudden everything is different and you don't really know how it got there so quickly. But it's actually Magneto and his acolytes in this dream who appear to fight the X-Men, not the protesters. As the two leaders, Xavier and Magneto, just sort of speechify their philosophies at each other. This is a very dramatic dream, but I guess Chuck is a very dramatic guy.
I mean, and if you're going to dream about Magneto, you might as well dream about him dramatic.
Yeah, fair point. Of note, in this dream, Magneto is talking about liberating mutants from the yoke of oppression, but it's typoed as Y-O-L-K. I mean, I guess egg yolks do contain a lot of cholesterol, and that's not good for you. Maybe the mutants need to watch what they're eating?
I got nothing.
Yeah, well, I guess what we have is mayonnaise or custard with that many egg yolks.
But Magneto has a lot to say, and one bit stands out in particular.
For too long have I agonized between what I knew in my mind and what I wished in my heart. For too long have I allowed the possibility of your dream to deter me from the reality of the situation.
Everything about this story has that kind of workmanlike quality, but Nicieza really does distill the characters to their cores quite nicely, I think, and especially the version of Magneto that exists in Xavier's head. Because Xavier, there's a part of him that thinks that Magneto is right, that his dream just doesn't work because the world keeps being fucked up.
Now, this isn't exactly a dream that Xavier is having on his own. He's got some help, and that help is coming from a group of acolytes who are doing their best to sneak into the mansion while keeping everyone asleep.
Okay, this is like the second time in a while that a bad guy has just snuck onto an X-campus with no detection or warning. Like, come on, at least get some motion sensors, at least get a floodlight, or I don't know, some guard geese. Maybe that would be too inhumane.
Yeah, that might be taking it a little far, Miles.
You don't want to fuck with geese. That's like the Avengers would never let you fuck with geese.
Yeah, don't fuck geese.
Also, don't fuck geese.
Sorry, what were we talking about?
Xavier's dreams. That were probably not about fucking geese, but might be.
I don't know, he's kind of terrible.
You know, don't yuck his yum. Don't yuck his honking, aggressive yum.
I will absolutely yuck that yum. And I'll feel ethical about it.
Fair point. Listeners, if any of you are geese, we don't want to demonize your sex lives, but also please stay away from us. We're scared of you.
Geese can do their own thing with other geese, but humans and geese cannot communicate enthusiastic mutual consent adequately.
That's probably true. Also, geese will fucking bite you.
This is basic. If you Google rules of monster fucking online, you can see this in simple cartoon form. Not with geese, but like it's a broad set of rules. And I think geese qualify as monsters.
You know, I've never Googled rules of monster fucking online.
Yeah, the question is basically, can you communicate clearly enough to determine that the monster you're interested in fucking is an adult, understands what you're proposing to it, and enthusiastically consents?
That actually sounds very reasonable. Yeah. Well done, internet, and I don't say that often. Anyway, the cause of this dream, geese regardless, was one of the acolytes, this dude named Remram. We haven't seen him before. That's a very silly name. I know, like, Rem, R-E-M, and Ram, like he's ramming his dreams into your Rem. I'm not really sure. I guess Ram is a computer term as well, of course, but whatever, let's not worry about it. The point is, he's one of the acolytes. The acolytes are the cult-like mutant former followers of Magneto, and then Magneto's successor, Exodus. And some of them are awesome, and some of them suck. And this faction is led by the one who sucks most of all.
That's right, it's Fabian Cortez.
This fucking guy. Okay, good things about Fabian Cortez. He's got a kind of cool ponytail. Bad things about Fabian Cortez. Everything else.
He's not a cool dude. He is nobody's friend.
No, he's a mean, whiny jerk that keeps betraying and manipulating and torturing everybody, and yet he still keeps failing upward into positions of leadership. X-Men has a lot of metaphors. So he actually murdered the first round of acolytes to gain points in this upstart game he was in. It was a whole thing in the early 90s.
Yeah, that's classic comics editor behavior.
That's actually a good point. He then tried to murder Magneto to get more upstart points, and tried to manipulate Joseph later into becoming his puppet to kill a whole bunch of people, and then tried to manipulate the acolytes into killing Joseph. Like, basically, Fabian Cortez is just the worst. He's like if Wormtongue from Lord of the Rings were really overconfident and had a ponytail, I guess.
Well, and acted independently more.
Anyway, they're attacking the mansion is the point through dreams. And Remram is messing with the dreams of a bunch of the X-Men. So, like, we see into Rogue's head. She's finding love in a genteel southern plantation era ball. Just like that time she did in a dream in Uncanny X-Men Annual number 11. Weird. That just doesn't seem like Rogue. Like, yeah, she comes from the south. I don't think that means she's, like, into freaking Gone with the Wind stuff, necessarily.
Yeah, get a new fantasy rogue.
In this case, we might yuck your yum, because your yum is inherently tied into a history of racism in America. So, yes, please get a new fantasy.
And chattel slavery, specifically.
Yes, yeah, it's not great. It's not great. Don't do that, rogue. Also, don't do that, writers. We love you, Alan Davis, but stop it. Anyway, that shifts into Magneto proposing to Rogue on a park bench, saying that he learned from Joseph how much he, Magneto, who's like Joseph but not Joseph, really did care for Rogue, and he wants her to be his queen as he creates his mutant haven. Which, of course, harkens back to the Age of Apocalypse, where Magneto and Rogue were married, and they were indeed defending a small mutant haven, as it turned out, unsuccessfully.
Now, this also harkens back to their romance in the Savage Land.
Right, yeah, we alluded to that before. That's the famous image of Rogue in a green and yellow bikini that's basically her uniform ripped up. That image, you see it a lot. I think that was very formative for a number of people. And in fact, here in her dream, she is so excited that Magneto can touch her hands to give her that ring that all of a sudden, the next panel, her outfit is gone and has been replaced with a tiny green bikini. So, take a drink as you rip off all your clothes at once to reveal your undergarments, but be careful not to spill while you rip everything.
Or take a drink, but like a magical dream drink.
Yeah, those are less satisfying. Well, I guess it depends. Gambit shows up in the dream to fight Magneto for Rogue, and the narration tells us that Rogue is secretly thrilled that men are fighting over her like in romance novels. I don't know about this portrayal of Rogue, Jay.
Yeah, we can blame Remram for this one.
Fucking Remram. I mean, he actually seems like a nice guy, but his boss is the worst.
Logan dreams of being torn apart by Magneto again, but that's probably what he was actually dreaming, so whatever.
Yeah, you know. Anyway, Remram heads back into Xavier's mind to try to trap Xavier more thoroughly in a dream where Xavier's shutting down Magneto's mind, like at the end of Fatal Attractions. But it doesn't work. Xavier wakes up and alerts the X-Men, and it's time for a big fight where half the people are wearing pajamas. Nightcrawler's wearing a long red nightcap, and it is adorable.
That's very silly.
It's very silly. The dialogue references it, so it's clear that Fabian Nicieza and Lee Weeks were on the same page about this nightcap. This is an important central part of this issue.
In fact, I would say even maybe the most important part of this issue, considering the pace of this story.
Yeah. So, okay, we know the X-Men. It's the same X-Men as before. We have Storm, Wolverine, Gambit, Rogue, Marrow, Colossus, Nightcrawler, and Shadowcat. What about the Acolytes?
Well, we've already covered Fabian Cortez and Remram.
There are also the Kleinstock brothers. Those are twins, formerly triplets, but one died, who can merge together into a big brother form, kind of like a station from Bill and Ted, and then zap people.
Good for them.
Yeah. There's Senyaka, who's a dude that wears wrappings around his face and has electro whips and was a cool action figure.
Wait a minute, he definitely died.
Twice, in fact. Once Magneto killed him as a lesson to the other Acolytes after Senyaka was murdering innocents, and once, more recently than that, Cable killed him. Like, come on, even the thinnest of explanations would be fine. Just have it be like in Final Fantasy II, where you kill the last boss and he comes back 5 minutes later saying that he conquered hell and thus was able to come back to fight you a second time. Like, just something, anything, Senyaka.
I don't know if Senyaka's quite up to conquering hell.
Probably not. I mean, he's got two electro whips, but, like, there are more than two demons. It would take a long time.
Like, he could maybe, like, conquer a little bit of hell, carve out his own tiny corner, set up a homestead.
A little Senyaka whip-based homestead.
Whee!
There's also Spore. That was the furry acolyte who was held on Muir Island for a while in Excalibur. That was the one also who baited Rory Campbell into getting his leg lasered off, thus setting Rory on the path to becoming evil future villain Ahab.
Yeah, Spore's not a great guy.
No. There's Projector, who was in the Quicksilver series we didn't cover, who can make hard light energy structures. There's Static, who can paralyze people. There's a new one named Barnacle, who can grow growths on people and is, like, super gross.
Using the moisture from their bodies. His abilities are so icky.
They're really icky, and the art makes it icky. So, and in fact, during the fight, he actually covers Storm in hardened growths in an attempt to trigger her claustrophobia. Like, does everyone in the world know about Storm's claustrophobia? Like, I know she declaims a lot, but still.
Well, it's in the handbook of Marvel Heroes.
Oh, it's just being consulted, like the way that Squirrel Girl consults her villain trading cards whenever she fights anyone?
Yes.
Well, okay. Well, I'm glad that my greatest fears aren't on some easy-to-find record. I'm not going to tell anyone what they are.
Green Ribbon.
Oh, shit. Now I'm going to be thinking about that the whole episode. Anyway, Nightcrawler phases Storm and also Kitty free of the creepy barnacles. He mentions he appreciates the chance to play Errol Flynn to Kitty's Alexis Smith, and I love this next part.
That Barnacle points out that Errol Flynn never wore a nightcap, not even in Gentleman Jim, the 1942 movie in which he co-starred with Alexis Smith.
I love that. I love that there's this fight and Nightcrawler and this new icky villain bond, like, over the fact that they love the same old movies.
And no weirdly specific trivia about the headgear in them.
I mean, you know, I feel like if Errol Flynn wore a nightcap, like, that would stick in your memory.
Maybe.
Maybe. Also notable during the fight, Fabian Cortez, being the worst, uses his mutant power to enhance others' mutants' powers to make Marrow's powers go out of control, so she has, like, all these 4-foot bone spikes stabbing out of her in all directions. She looks like an agonized sea urchin.
Fortunately, Kitty is able to phase Marrow free from her own bone growths, and I question the logic of that, but you know what? Sure.
I'm just thinking about the fact that once Marrow is phased free of that, there's still this, like, gigantic ball of spikes. Like, I don't know, I played a lot of Jedi Survivor recently on the PlayStation, and you could use telekinesis to just throw those at someone, and it would hurt a lot.
They can work it into the danger room. It's very, very danger room looking.
Yeah, I could just see Professor X being like, Remy, please hang on to those. We can throw them at some youth later.
Exactly.
So Cortez is just continually trying to push Remram to use his powers more and more to, like, turn the fight around, well past the point of safety. And when the X-Men rescue Ram-Ram from this, the Acolytes are like, all right, Fabian, it's pretty clear you don't care about any of us. And also, we think you're the worst and you do not deserve that ponytail. We all quit. X-Men, we surrender.
And the X-Men are like, cool. And Xavier's like, nope. House is full. Fuck off.
I no longer have the compassion to forgive your actions or the energy to teach you to have it for others.
I mean, they're literally begging sanctuary at this point.
It's kind of dark and messed up. And he does mention that, like, hey, he tried taking in Sabretooth and that went very, very badly. Which, I mean, yes, it did. But
these are not comparable situations.
No, and also none of the Acolytes are as bad as Sabretooth. Like, Sabretooth is extra, extra dangerous. And these Acolytes are, well, they kind of suck, honestly. So the Acolytes just sort of blink a couple times and wander off. And Xavier mentions his other reason for not taking them in.
That's right. He sensed that Fabian Cortez believed that Magneto had returned and figured that the Acolytes would head back to their old boss and the X-Men can follow them.
That's, like, really cold, though. I mean, Rogue even mentions, dude, you took me and Wolverine in. We were basically villains.
Xavier's like, yeah, well, fuck you.
But I don't know. I think this kind of does work. I mean, certainly Xavier just flashed back to the time he shut down Magneto's mind after Magneto did horrible things in Fatal Attractions. And he knows that part of why he became Onslaught and did terrible things to the world was because of Magneto's evil in the form of a tiny hate goblin influencing him to do so. So I can see him being straight up terrified that if Magneto is back, he'll do even worse things this time.
Meanwhile, in Israel, a man who is not Magneto, it's Joseph, is hanging out, basically being a lab test subject as people try to figure out whether or not he's actually Magneto.
And, you know, this is more poignant than it might be, because Joseph has tried so hard over the course of years, like he was on the X-Men for a long time, it's easy to forget that, to be everything Magneto wasn't, to be a hero where Magneto was a villain, to take his history of pain and oppression and turn it into a quest for justice, not vengeance. There's a little line in the dialogue that Nicieza does that's actually really great.
How can one man be both dragon and shining knight?
So now Joseph is on his own trying to figure this out, having just noped out of the X-Mansion without giving anyone any notice. And even if the X-Men don't know where he is, it looks like one person does.
That is Quicksilver, Magneto's on-again, off-again son.
At this point in continuity, Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch are indeed Magneto's children. Later on, that will be retconned to not be the case. But at this point, it is. And they have a heart-to-heart. It's like a really nice interaction about second chances, kind of like they did back in X-Men number 58. They continue the conversation now. One really fun thing is that Quicksilver points out that it's weird that he's Joseph's son, but he is older than Joseph, paging Dr. Summers.
No, he never finished that. He's still just got a master's, I think.
Oh, yeah, well, there is that.
Joseph says to Quicksilver,
I'm sorry. That sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? I'm sorry for not having been a better father to a son I do not even remember. Quicksilver replies,
it's the thought that counts, and as I've recently come to realize, your thoughts are usually kind ones. You're a good man, Joseph. The kind of man we all wish my father had been.
Man, this poor kid. These poor kids. Nothing good will ever happen to either of these characters. I mean, some good things will happen, but mostly bad things.
Now, the actual Magneto is hanging out in the Netherlands.
He's speaking to a squad of less terrible acolytes, the ones he actually did gather to work for him, as opposed to the other ones he told Fabian to just sort of fuck off toward the X-Men with.
I like the idea that he set up Fabian Cortez and those acolytes like the way you'd distract a kid.
I like that idea. I'm kind of reminded of that line from that old movie Kung Pao Enter the Fist. We taught him wrong, as a joke.
Yeah, pretty much.
Actually, the last time we saw the Acolytes, they did also have two factions. There were those who were trying to work for Exodus, Magneto's kind of successor, and then those who weren't, who were with Fabian Cortez, who was trying to manipulate everyone. So there's precedent here.
So who's with Magneto now?
Well, we'll get to some of the others, but most centrally, Amelia Vogt. That's Professor X's, well, X, who then became an acolyte. In the recent Magneto miniseries, where Joseph was kind of leading the acolytes, she was very much a good guy, very much a hero. Fabian Cortez spent a lot of the miniseries torturing her. And here, you know, it's the same Amelia we've seen before. She has a good heart, she wants good things for the world, but she's very cold and kind of mean.
And Magneto has a specialized assignment for her. He's already lost one child, his daughter Anya, and he wants Amelia to make sure that his current nominal children, Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch, are protected while he
burns the blight of humanity off the face of the planet forevermore.
Aw, that's the Magneto we know and love.
And then I'll grab a banana milkshake from Checkers and maybe some of those seasoned fries that I just can't stop eating. They're so good.
Oh man, Magneto with product placement would be very funny.
Oh god, it really would.
Like keeping his same tone, but like occasionally working in something like that.
I love that idea of just having like really dramatic supervillains advertise your shit.
See, that's always sort of what I've thought. If we ever decided to have advertising on the show, which we're not going to, that the way to do it would be just to go into extended explanations.
Oh man, like in character
like,
voices.
Yeah, well, you know, be like, this, yeah. So now, concurrent to this, Hostess Fruit Pies were, in fact, that's the only advertiser I think we'd accept, is Hostess Fruit Pies.
Oh, they do have a long history of relationships with comic books. It's true.
Yeah, like I would shill for Hostess Fruit Pies just for the sake of that synchronicity.
That said, I really do want to see Apocalypse advertise Little Caesars.
Pizza! Pizza!
It would be great.
Only until he tries and can't resist the taste of a Hostess Fruit Pie.
Good point. Damn it. Anyway, let's follow those pies into Uncanny X-Men number 366, The Shot Heard Round the World.
It's a story by Alan Davis, script by Fabian Nicieza, pencils by Lanil Francis Yu, inks by John Livesay, Tim Townsend, and Ed Tadeo, colors by Liquid, graphics and letters by Richard Starkings and Comicraft.
I really like Lanil Francis Yu's art. It's really detailed and textured with at least some of the inkers. It really varies based on inker, but it's a nice style. It fits the story as well. Like, it's sort of serious, for lack of a better term.
Yes, it is grave, as befits Dick War.
Dick War. There's a manga called Dick Fight Island I heard about recently. It's kind of what it sounds like, actually.
Yeah, that's what I've heard as well.
Earth certainly is full of things.
Thank you, King of All Cosmos.
Anyway, the Acolytes have been off blowing up genetic research labs and stealing stuff, at least according to a report by Trish Tilby, who doesn't look anything like she's looked in the past. She actually looks a lot like the version of herself in the series finale of the original X-Men animated series. I watched that right before the new show premiered. Again, the new show, shockingly good.
I'm planning to watch it this coming weekend as we record this, so that's my hot take.
I'm glad you have that ahead of you. It's really fun. Anyway, the X-Men are tracking the Acolytes, just like Professor Xavier said they were planning to do. So you have the Acolytes and then the Track-alytes. The thing is, they're pretty sure that Magneto was mind-wiped and de-aged and became Joseph. So they actually think that it's Joseph, who, remember, did just disappear from the X-Men with no notice, who's doing this. And this raises a question. Was no one paying attention to the recent time that Magneto revealed his return by terrorizing a construction foreman? Like, I'm pretty sure that was a very public thing that happened. Someone must have had a camera.
Dude, it's New York.
Oh, that's just, that sort of thing just happens? Like, it just blends into all of the other disasters going on?
I don't know. I didn't live here in the late 90s. I can only assume.
I'm told the city's changed. It's true.
Rent's definitely gone up. That's why Magneto can't afford to terrorize people here anymore.
They've gentrified Magneto out. He now has to, like, do supervillainy in more rural areas.
He's relegated to the suburbs.
That's actually a hilarious mental image. Just him and his big, like, glowy magnetic sphere just going down a street with a bunch of samey houses, like all of their station wagons getting smashed into their doors and stuff.
It's very Waiting for the Trade.
It is very Waiting for the Trade. Like, someone's little dog is just chasing after Magneto, and the dog's owner is chasing after the dog. Like, get back here!
And he's really only doing it to yell at the Scarlet Witch to put on a sweater.
Right? You'll get cold!
I'd read that Magneto War before I'd read this one again.
Give it the same creative team. The creative team's doing the best they can with the material.
Can you imagine how much better Magneto War had been if they'd given Alan Davis, like, the rough premise and then just been like, do your own thing?
Oh, man. Like, let us never forget that in his first issue of Excalibur that he wrote as well as drew, there was a tiny little Tweety bird named Hardboiled Henry who was a living bomb. Like, that's how Alan Davis starts a run.
This is a man who knows how to comic book.
He is. Anyway, in this comic book, the X-Men catch the Acolytes in the act at their next laboratory target. Here we see some of the hand-selected team of Acolytes that are working for Magneto. There's Frenzy. Hey, it's Frenzy. I love Frenzy.
Yay!
That's Joanna Cargill. So I love her for a number of reasons, but one of them, as I've mentioned on this show before, is that she was one of the antagonists in the first comic book I ever remember when I was a small child, X-Factor number 4, which was read to me as a bedtime story. Also, she's just a badass character and gets really interesting in stories like Age of X.
Yeah, she's great. Also on the team is Neophyte, who seems to have adopted that as his code name.
Right! This was this red-haired teenager who was a young Acolyte in Uncanny X-Men number 300, and that was just his rank, or perhaps just descriptor, because Neophyte, of course, means, you know, someone who's new at a thing.
I thought that was just what Fabian Cortez called him, to be mean but fancy about it.
Maybe. But yeah, that's his official code name now. It's like your code name being Rookie or Greenhorn or something. So there's a fight. It goes very badly for the X-Men. They actually get their asses kicked. The Acolytes wash them away by rupturing a coolant tank, and they almost drown. It's very sad.
It is, but it's pretty fun. And the Acolytes really have their act together.
Their Actolyte, if you will.
I will not.
Well, I will. So the Acolytes, the thing is, they don't run away very fast, and it becomes quickly clear that they're actually leading the X-Men on.
Uh-oh, that's never good.
It's not.
Where are the X-Men being led?
They're being led to Magneto's giant techno tower that he has constructed in the Arctic Circle.
You'd think someone would notice.
What, penguins? There's not a lot of people around.
It's the late 90s, there are satellites.
Well, not anymore, after Magneto presumably zapped them.
Oh, point.
Magneto does have a habit of having elaborate bases at one of the poles. Don't forget his Antarctic volcano base that he had back in the 70s.
He's a man of simple and specific tastes.
See, that's the thing. Everybody remembers him as this morally gray character, you know, Holocaust survivor, has had this complicated relationship with morality and with Professor X. But he is also a guy that builds giant mechanical towers all the fuck over the place. And he had a magnet car at one point that was shaped like one of those U-shaped magnets.
And he spent an entire issue checking out Namor's butt.
Sure did.
As did the readers.
Yeah. So in that Magneto is channeling a bit of his old Silver Age villainy, he is also thus channeling a bit of his old Silver Age tower building.
Well, and his Silver Age tendency toward robots.
Yeah, that's right. He has a robot named Ferris, who is his butler slash majordomo slash Metatron.
I assume your consumables proved satisfactory, my liege.
Breakfast was fine, Ferris.
I am pleased. The human organism requires sustenance, even one such as you.
Human.
My most sincere apologies for daring to impugn the genetic superiority that is Magneto, master of the electromagnetic fire.
Oh, I accept. But save your flowery patter for the United Nations.
I am programmed for an inexhaustible supply of patter.
Much to my chagrin. My helmet, please.
Wait a minute. Isn't Magneto presumably the one who programmed him with that inexhaustible supply of patter?
I guess he also programmed Ferris with banter, because that's what they're doing.
A sure sign that you are prepared to enter into battle.
The players are in place. Chaos percolates. Fear brews. Decisions will be born of panic. Oh, indeed, Ferris. It most certainly is time to strike.
He's using a lot of coffee metaphors. I wonder if that's because he just had breakfast.
It's just what was on his mind at the time. I guess yeah. It's better than, like, I don't know, poached egg metaphors.
And as Magneto declaims, he channels energy upward to disrupt the planet's electromagnetic field.
That's right, because this giant techno tower is basically a big focusing antenna. And, it works. The electromagnetic field is rocked and disrupted worldwide, just like it was in Fatal Attractions. And the X-Men, despite their best efforts, crash into the snow. A snow crash, if you will.
Ferris, for his part, shows up at the UN, very politely requests that the cops who attempt to shoot him stop doing so, as his body is impenetrable and civilians and innocents might be hurt by the ricochet.
I love this. Like, a cop suggests that they should call the Avengers, and another cop replies,
"And tell him what? A polite robot just walked into the UN?"
It's great. So Ferris delivers the prepared speech.
That's right. The leaders of the world have been bickering over nonsense as the world starves and persecutes those who are different. And Magneto is done with this bullshit. He is going to electromagnetically shut civilization down entirely unless they give him a country.
And this doesn't initially sound as bad as it actually is. It's like, oh, what? People won't be able to use their TVs? Who cares? But, like, remember, this is the entire electromagnetic field. All the things that civilization is based on, including, you know, planes that are in the sky, or life support systems in hospitals, like things that are keeping people alive, heat in Alaska, air conditioning in Florida, like, which actually you do need or you die sometimes, like for real. This would not only bring civilization to a halt, it would kill, I mean, probably millions, right?
Yeah, it's a bad thing. They should just give them the country.
So that's the demand, and those are the stakes. He wants his own mutant nation. Now, of course, the idea of a sovereign mutant nation is one that we're going to come back to again and again. Coming up, it'll be this. More recently, well, there was, you know, Krakoa. In between, there was Utopia, which was independent, albeit not a nation. This is a frequent X theme, and I think this is actually, until Krakoa, one of the more interesting examples of it.
So meanwhile, the scientists studying Joseph have come to a conclusion. They have figured out his true nature. And y'all, this is some of the goofiest shit ever to come out of a scientist's mouth in a comic book. And that is saying something.
That's right. Dr. Science here concludes that while Joseph is genetically identical to Magneto,
the DNA itself is a forgery.
Wait, what? Like, the A's and C's and T's and G's are, like, in the slightly wrong handwriting? Like,
yes.
The T slants to the left? Or what the fuck?
And, Joseph wanders out processing this nonsense, and he runs into a woman in a power suit. Important qualifier, like 80s shoulder pads power suit, not, like, super mandroid power suit. And she has no patience for his moping. She zaps him with a big blast from her hands and says to call her mother.
So there we go. We're still in the middle of the Magneto War. The story is ongoing, but I kind of love ending it there because what the hell?
With that, you've got questions. Sapphic Sophos asks on Tumblr. So there's been a bunch of Southern mutants over the years. Gambit's from Louisiana. The Guthries are from Kentucky, except for when they're not. Rogue is from Mississippi, etc. Have there ever been any from Georgia?
So, yes. Sapphic Sophos also mentions that, you know, Marvel's U.S. agent is from Georgia, but A, not a mutant, and B, kind of a jerk. So, as far as mutants, I would be happy to answer this as a fellow kinda sorta Southerner by origin, but also because I get to bring up my favorite forgotten X-team. Kevin Ford, a.k.a. Wither, who was a member of the 2000s squad of New Mutants and then Hellions in New Mutants Volume 2, New X-Men Academy X, and New X-Men Volume 2. Anyway, yeah, he's from Georgia. That was the guy who had an uncontrollable death touch, and then everything just went gradually horribly wrong for him, and he ended up hooking up with Celine. Like, yeah, hooking up with Celine.
That's bad.
It's really bad. I will always love that team. Like, it is one of my perpetual pet peeves that there was this entire team of young characters, and some of them, like, you know, Rockslide and Hellion became more prominent, and so many of them were just forgotten. Like, it's nice seeing Prodigy these days, but what about Wallflower? What about Winddancer? What about Surge, who led the goddamn team?
Well, Winddancer got very murdered at the beginning of the current age of X-Factor.
Well, I mean, yeah, but, you know, there's the Krakoan thing. She got better, I think. Still, I don't know. I miss that team as much as I love the original New Mutants, and I do love the original New Mutants. Like, there's just been so much history since then. It seems like the entire 2000s are just introducing a bunch of characters two of them enter into continuity and the rest are completely erased from everyone's memory. Anyway, so Kevin Ford, though, will remind everyone of him here in this question. There's also another mutant, Gordo Fraley, a.k.a. Puff Adder of the Serpent Society. He is from Georgia, and his mutant power is to puff up, which makes him big and strong.
The Serpent Society is the non-racist snake team.
Well, I think he was on the racist one as well. I forget which one he was on more than the other.
And Serpent Society is the one that's morally gray.
Oh, okay.
I think it's like Brilliant. Brotherhood of the Serpent or something. That's the white supremacist snake guys.
I don't know. Man, don't be racist, snake guys. Just be snakes. Just be puff adder. Just puff up. And
snakes are so cool.
Snakes are really cool.
They've got such doofy little faces.
Yeah, they taste the air. I love that. As a bonus, I did have to look up mutants from Florida. Domino, technically from Florida. Risk, as we know, from Florida. Also, Logan's kid, Jimmy Hudson, from the Ultimate Universe.
Well, presumably he's from Ultimate Florida.
Ultimate Florida. Oh, God, I don't want to know what Ultimate Florida's like. Then you have Ultimate Florida, man. I also looked up Indiana, since that's where you're from, Jay. I couldn't find any mutants, but you do get the cast of both Parks and Rec and Stranger Things. As far as Marvel Universe characters, most importantly, you know who's from Indiana?
It better be Stiltman.
Even better. Fucking Paste Pot Pete. Daniel Hudak emailed us to ask, how does Storm fly? It seems pretty apparent, Wind Rider, and we often see her blow enemies off their feet. But if that's the case, why does she need to carry allies when she flies? Couldn't she just create wind for them too?
Okay. So Daniel, I am going to build a metaphor for you. Imagine that you are a surfer. You know how to surf. You're good at surfing. And you also know how to control the waves. Like you have water mutant powers. So you are very good at surfing and you can get anywhere on your surfboard. You know, not like through time and space, like Slipstream, because fuck that guy. But, you know, anywhere within reason on any body of water. Let's say you want to bring along your buddy Logan. And Logan is a small, cranky Canadian who may or may not be very dense, depending on the era. He's got a lot going on. But Logan does not surf. So you can put him on the surfboard. You can control the waves. And odds are still very good that he's going to fall off, and he might drown, depending on his relative density at the time. This, I would imagine, is roughly the same as the issue that Storm faces with just throwing folks onto the wind rather than carrying them herself. She knows how to ride and interact with the wind, with the elemental forces she's controlling. The people who she's bringing along with her have nowhere near her level of experience, expertise, or just innate instinctual understanding of how to do that.
Yeah, pretty much. It's easier just to drag them along. Although the mutant surfing pedant in me does have to point out, Jay, that while your metaphor is an excellent one, Logan does, in fact, surf. He got into a surfboard fight with a bunch of surfboard bad guys recently in the Krakoan era. There were adamantium surfboards involved, and it was ridiculous.
Bold of you to assume that Daniel's imaginary friend Logan is the same as Logan for the X-Men, Miles.
Oh, good point. Could just be a different dense Logan who isn't good at surfing.
There are plenty.
Thousands. And with that,
Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men is recorded in Forest Hills, New York and Portland, Oregon, and produced by Matt Hunter, who also arranged our theme music. You can find more of Matt's work at moon-talk.bandcamp.com, and you can hear him DJ in person at our birthday party this April 13th at Books with Pictures.
New episodes come out most Sundays on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and ExplainTheXMen.com.
Check out ExplainTheXMen.com for a visual companion to every episode, and again, for information on our upcoming birthday party.
Our show is 100% listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air and ad-free, even free of Hostess Fruit Pie ads, check out the Patreon link at the top of ExplainTheXMen.com.
And please take a moment to try out the delicious taste of Hostess Fruit Pies. To rate and review us on your favorite podcasting platform, because it really helps.
Next week, the Magneto War ends.
Spoiler, Magneto wins.